More nuclear weapons. Why? The United States already has an arsenal of more than 5,000 nuclear warheads, more than enough to blast the entire planet to kingdom come. Yet, the White House is pushing for more nukes, and for it to happen fast. Indeed, at the recent Nuclear Deterrence Summit in D.C., a glad-handing networking event for those who collaborate to create our shared nuclear nightmare, at least one executive branch official reported that the orders from the White House were two words: go fast. And how will these minions convince us that we must rush towards the nuclear precipice? It takes the lone oppositional activist attendee at the event to give us a frontline report on what those people are thinking and how they are saying it. And when he tells us...
Someone who was there ran their computer notes through ChatGPT and asked for some generalizations. And one of the generalizations that was drawn was that nuclear deterrence is something which must be constantly produced. And it is not something that exists without the effort and investment. So terms like signaling results, making these investments and meeting these schedules, signals resolve, without too much further explanation.
Well, when Greg Mello of the Los Alamos Study Group reports back from the recent Nuclear Deterrence Summit in D.C. to inform us as to what those people are thinking and how they get to those talking points, you get a glimpse of the future that just might lie ahead of us if we are forced deeper into that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, an interview with Greg Mello. He is the founder and executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group, and he's just back from the two-day Nuclear Deterrence Summit in D.C. That's where the military, government, and corporate forces responsible for creating our ongoing nuclear nightmare meet, greet, and hatch schemes to expand our nuclear arsenal while enriching themselves. Talk about being in the belly of the beast. That's exactly where Greg was. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, and lots more honest and verified nuclear information. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, February 10, 2026, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here's Linda Pence Gunter with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, discussing why nuclear nations should disarm first before telling other countries such as Iran that they can't have the bomb.
The trouble with telling Iran it can't have nuclear weapons is, look who's doing the talking. The United States, which at more than 5,000 nuclear weapons has the second largest inventory in the world behind Russia. And Israel, an undeclared nuclear weapons nation with anywhere from 80 to 200 bombs. Israel is actually allowed to maintain a position of nuclear opacity within the UN, neither confirming nor denying its nuclear arsenal. This is despite the fact that the UN General Assembly adopts a resolution every year calling on Israel to renounce possession of nuclear weapons and to place its nuclear facilities under international supervision, something the Jerusalem Center for Security and Foreign Affairs describes as the annual three-month Israel bashing festival. Since we know that US President Trump doesn't actually care whether or not the Iran government is shooting demonstrators in the streets, especially given he is quite happy for his own homeland security thugs to do it here, albeit in not nearly as high numbers, or not yet, we must reckon with the other motivations for continuing to threaten Iran, and one of those is absolutely about stopping Iran from developing the bomb. There is further irony here because, unlike nuclear-armed Israel, non-nuclear-armed Iran is a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, known for short as the NPT. And unlike the US, Iran has so far abided by its terms. Article 4, one of the major flaws of the NPT as Iran perfectly exemplifies, gives signatories the inalienable right to develop nuclear power as long as they don't transition to nuclear weapons development. Article 6 demands that the nuclear-armed nations pursue negotiations in good faith on effective measures relating to cessation of the nuclear arms race at an early date and to nuclear disarmament. Iran could argue that it is abiding by Article 4. The US clearly cannot make the case that it is abiding in any way by Article 6. On the contrary, with the collapse last week of the New START Treaty, the last surviving nuclear arms reduction treaty between the US and Russia, both countries could now significantly ramp up their respective arsenals. According to a statement put out last week by the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, which won the Nobel Peace Prize back in 1985, these increases could happen by uploading additional warheads on each country's existing long-range missiles. This would mark the first increase in the sizes of their deployed nuclear arsenals in more than 35 years. According to independent estimates, Moscow and Washington could double the number of strategic deployed warheads after New START. Iran's nuclear facilities were seemingly pulverized by the provocative bombing raids carried out by Israel and the US last June, but they were by no means completely obliterated, as Trump claimed. New satellite imagery suggests there is currently considerable activity at the Iranian nuclear sites the US and Israel attacked, but some of these appear to be simple repairs, such as the rebuilding of roofs and other structures destroyed in those attacks. Iran has and may well continue to insist it is developing its uranium enrichment capabilities for a civil nuclear program, and that could be true, or not. The level to which it has lately been enriching uranium, to at least 60% and possibly higher, before first Israel and then the US bombed its nuclear facilities, puts it in that grey area of weapons usable rather than weapons-grade uranium enrichment. A delegation from the White House went to Oman last Friday to negotiate a new nuclear deal with Iran, even though it was Trump's own regime back in 2018 that destroyed the perfectly workable Iran nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. That had been in place up until then. The negotiating team was led by Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner. Witkoff is Trump's Middle East envoy, but Kushner has no official position within the US government and no actual qualifications. But as we know, he has a keen predatory eye for profiteering in foreign lands. Iran has 5,800 kilometers of coastline along the Caspian Sea, the Persian Gulf, and the Sea of Oman that could be causing Kushner to harbor visions of Riviera's future. Should Iran have nuclear weapons? Of course not. But that also goes for the nine nations who do, and they should be the first to disarm before any demands are made elsewhere. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat, and that's this week's hot story.
Here's this week's featured interview. Greg Mello is executive director and a founder of the Los Alamos Study Group, which seeks nuclear disarmament, environmental protection and enhancement, social justice, and economic sustainability, goals which are closely interrelated, mutually reinforcing, and essential to one another. They aim to not only change public policy, but to prevent the implementation of bad policies. To that end, Greg recently attended the 18th annual Nuclear Deterrence Summit in D.C., a two-day pro-nuke love fest that brings together key players in the U.S. and international nuclear deterrence community. Note that languaging is important here. They don't say nuclear weapons, because that's what they're talking about, but it's all about nuclear deterrence, and they're attempting to implement it at what is being labeled the speed of national need. We'll have more on the false narrative of deterrence after the interview. Greg, of course, is clearly an oppositional voice. But how much voice was he allowed to have at this event? To find out, I spoke with Greg Mello on February 9, 2026. Greg Mello, it is always great to have you here with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
It's wonderful to be here, Libby. Thank you so much.
You recently returned from Washington, D.C., where you attended the Nuclear Deterrence Summit, sometimes referred to as NDS. What is that?
Well, it's kind of a Davos for warheads. It is a corporate get-together with government to determine what the main talking points are and purposes so that contract language can be aligned. Companies can raid each other's executives and secret deals can be worked out because these companies rent meeting rooms inside the same hotel complex for their private get-togethers. But government officials explain where we're going with the program, and the latest set of buzzwords are used so that everybody's on the same page.
So in other words, they're getting their talking points lined up so that nobody contradicts anybody else.
Yes. And in this case, the talking points are the talking points of the Trump administration as it is now ready to go. Now that the head of the NNSA, that stands for National Nuclear Security Administration, has been confirmed by the Senate and has arrived on the scene, we have a Secretary of Energy, and then under him is this NNSA administrator, and then under him there are deputies and so forth, and they are all in place. And so now the rickety juggernaut of the nuclear warhead enterprise can really get going.
One of the words or terms that I heard coming up repeatedly in this extensive report that you sent out to your mailing list, they all have to do with speed and the need to hurry and the urgency. It's like there's something nipping at their heels and they have to run as fast as they can to create as many nukes and bigger nukes and delivery systems. For what reason? What is this sudden push for speed?
Mostly that remains unstated. Someone who was there ran their computer notes through ChatGPT and asked for some generalizations. And one of the generalizations, the logical generalizations that was drawn, was that nuclear deterrence is something which must be constantly produced. And it is not something that exists without the effort and investment. So terms like signaling resolve, making these investments and meeting these schedules signals resolve without too much further explanation. There was some specifics. One of the, well, the first speaker in the first morning before reporters were allowed said that we have to get ready for a possible war with China coming at about the end of this administration, as early as next year and as late as 2029. We need to be able to deter China. No one ever says going to war. We just have to deter. And they spoke of deterrence gaps that had been identified that needed to be filled with new kinds of nuclear weapons. There are several new kinds of nuclear weapons being developed at Los Alamos and Livermore, which are going to be shopped around to the military. There are, at the present time, two new kinds of nuclear weapons that are in front of the Nuclear Weapons Council right now. That's the body that is formed from the military, the civilian Pentagon, and the Department of Energy that makes the decision recommendations that go to the Oval Office for Trump to initial for how big the stockpile is, what kind of weapons, so forth. So the Nuclear Weapons Council is the principal executive branch decision body, and they have two new weapons in front of that right now. And more are in the works.
What are those weapons so we can be aware of what is unfortunately on the horizon?
Well, we don't know for sure, but they did mention new weapons for hard and deeply buried targets. So people dig into the ground to hide from the United States' nuclear weapons. And there needs to be ways to kill them. And the other is next generation re-entry vehicles. You know, the Russians have maneuverable hypersonic re-entry vehicles that can glide and fly around, change course. And I'm sure there's quite a bit of nuclear envy about that. So I don't know what a next generation re-entry vehicle is unless it's something that maneuvers, because the accuracy is already very high. So your guess is as good as mine.
You know, when you talked about deterrence gaps, citing that as one of the talking points, what my mind went to was Dr. Strangelove and the mine shaft gap that they're talking about at the end between Russia and the United States, with the exact same level of absurdity. Because we are talking about weapons that are magnitudes more powerful than that which was dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
For the most part, there are also baby ones.
Oh, and aren't they cute?
Yeah, ones that won't self-deter. A gentleman at the Heritage Foundation tried to tell me that he could show how we could attack Chinese airfields without causing any civilian casualties using just right size nuclear weapons. So there's a Goldilocks aspect to this. In fact, they do know what they want. The term was unique weapons for specific applications that were made in quantities of tens rather than hundreds. So special weapons for specific purposes.
Mini nukes, as it were.
Could be mini nukes, it could be enhanced radiation weapons, it could be enhanced electromagnetic pulse weapons, which could be used to disable an entire country, as our colleague Steve Starr has explained in a book. The electromagnetic pulse weapons could take out the US electric grid, which is large, of course, all the separate regional grids, and leave the US without electricity to pump water or treat sewage or transport things, make anything. And under that scenario, pretty much everybody dies quickly.
We had Stephen Starr on this program and talking about his book and the power of a single EMP well placed in space to instantaneously take out the grid with no ability to rebuild it. So there are many different ways that a nuclear weapon can be used to destroy a country or a region, without thinking about what the collateral damage is to the rest of the planet, to the ecosphere, to the human race, and to our genetic future, just to name a few of the consequences.
Yes.
I find that the title of this symposium, this summit, Accelerating the Mission, Delivering Deterrence with Urgency, is this an edict coming out of the White House? Is this something they've come up with on their own to appease certain needs of the White House? Where is this rush coming from?
That's a great question, and it's mysterious. Mysterious origins lie in the nuclear deep state, and it's definitely in the White House. But the program committee of this conference, and it's useful to see who these people were. The program committee consisted of the chief growth officer of such and such company, the strategic development officer of another, business development officer, strategy and business operation, director for mission solutions, president of another company, senior business development director, vice president, Bechtel. Anyway, these were corporate growth executives, marketing people that determined what happened at this conference. Now, that said, this morning I spoke with an executive branch official, I won't further identify him, who told me that the direction that his group had received from the White House was, quote, go fast, end quote. And his responsibilities are nuclear weapons. And those two words pretty much sum up the conference. Go fast.
Be big, go fast.
Yes, get big or go home. And the other part of the message from the president's office was either support the policy agenda or quit. And so, you know, no disloyalists, disloyal people. So there's a lot of pressure, and it was manifested in various ways. One thing that's happening is that the DOE orders and standards are being changed to cut the red tape and get some of the safety and security and construction regulations taken out of the way.
What are some of the ill-advised shortcuts that are going to have to be instituted in order to speed up the process?
Well, we don't know for sure what all of them are. This is a work in progress, work in rapid progress. So previous administrations have bemoaned the red tape that encrusts all the big construction projects and slows down these programs. The difference now is that Trump is cutting through these. So they are eliminating hundreds of pages of regulations. There is apparently a program called Project Velocity, and it seems to be a capital P, capital V effort. Systematically reviews DOE orders to determine which requirements remain necessary, which add unnecessary costs and delays across about 80 DOE orders. So these deal with everything from security, groundwater protection, worker safety. They are aiming to eliminate the as low as reasonably achievable principle from DOE regulations.
And explain what that means.
The ELARA principle, or as low as reasonably achievable, has been a cornerstone of radiation safety across both the civilian and military nuclear industries for as long as I've been alive. And this department was pushed by the nuclear energy industry to ask for a white paper from the Idaho National Laboratory that attacked the ELARA principle along with the linear no threshold model that says that for all these decades, the data has shown that there's no lower threshold below which radiation becomes safe. 2 units of radiation is twice as dangerous as 1 unit of radiation all the way down. And the DOE wants to get rid of this now, and instead hypothesize that there is a minimum level of radiation which is safe, that both the public and the workers especially can be exposed to. And this greatly, as you could imagine, greatly eases the problem of licensing new kinds of nuclear reactors very quickly overall. But the nuclear weapons business has seized upon this also. So the Nuclear Energy Office of DOE started this. They were, as one safety official explained to me, the prime mover in loosening these regulations. But the military side has followed along, and they also want to loosen the regulations because they are in the way of this need for speed, which has been articulated. So, an example at Los Alamos National Laboratory, the maximum exposure of a radiation worker has been held to one rem per year.
A REM being a measurement of radiation.
Yes, of radiation effect, really, in the body. So, like a physics measurement would be a rad, but the rem is what it does to you. So, the limit has been one rem per year for a worker. Now, without telling anybody, until this conference, no one knew, it's been changed to five. So it's now five rems per year. Five times the radiation is now allowed to a worker at Los Alamos National Lab.
And generally speaking, broad strokes, how dangerous is exposure to one REM per year in terms of health compromise?
I wish I could give you an expert answer on that. I don't know how they compare, but it's not safe. That's the point. It really isn't safe. There's a finite risk that you are exposed to at one rem, and it's five times as great at five rem under the linear model, which is the only one that most of the world now, except for the Trump administration, follows. So far, the Department of Energy is only changing its, to my knowledge, its orders and standards. They have not attempted to change the Code of Federal Regulations. So the five rems at Los Alamos is in the Code of Federal Regulations. They will need to have a notice and comment period before they can change that regulation. There's a much more formal process. The orders and standards are their own, sort of like memos to file. This is how we're going to do it within the standard of the regulation. But many of us are waiting for the time when that regulation is changed. So we're waiting for the other shoe to drop. Will they try to change the Code of Federal Regulations? If so, when? And if so, how? And bodies like the Defense Nuclear Facility Safety Board are trying to get ready for that.
This summit sounds like it was a Christmas wish list from the nuclear industry and the warmongers and the manufacturers and the like to get everything they want with all of the obstacles taken away from them. Yet, you said that a common tagline that was used on slide decks was peace through atomic strength,
Yes.
which sounds like something Orwell would have put into 1984. Was there any contrary voice allowed during this from the presenters, let's start out with, let alone from the audience other than you? And were you allowed to speak at all?
There was not a single contrary voice to be heard. Very few questions were allowed. And the more controversial the topic, the fewer questions were allowed. In most of the, sub-events, the panels, there were no questions. So it was really different in that way too. It was, if you want to use the word authoritarian, you could. It would be all right to use that word. That was fairly accurate.
We'll be back with the second half of this week's featured interview with Greg Mello, Executive Director of the Los Alamos Study Group, in just a moment. But first, not a good time for those of us advocating for sanity when it comes to nuclear weapons and reactors. The last remaining arms control treaty with Russia, New START, expired last Thursday, February 5th, with not a twitch of interest from the U.S. in extending it, despite Putin's offer to extend it another year. As you heard in this week's interviews thus far, the Trump administration has secretly overhauled a set of nuclear safety directives and shared them with companies it is charged with regulating. And this was without making the new rules available to the public. And his order for the nuclear deterrence summit was simple. Go fast. Make more nuclear weapons, all sizes, different delivery systems, as fast as you can. So we can take out not just our perceived enemies, but, in all probability, life on Earth. What can be done to turn this trajectory of madness around? That's what we address on this program, and that's why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. Every week, we bring you a range of stories, interviews, and special features from a different perspective that allow you to understand what's going on in the nuclear world, and then provide you with actions and directions as to what you can do about it. We the people are not powerless, and that includes our concerns regarding the future of all things nuclear. In order to fight back, we need honest information, and one of the few places for you to find it is here, every week, on Nuclear Hot Seat. But we cannot do this show without your help. Nuclear Hot Seat runs on donations, and without them, the show cannot continue. That's why the time would be right now to support us with a donation of any size. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, and follow the prompts. Or, if you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And with Zelle, there are no fees taken out. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that anything you donate is tax deductible. Any amount helps, so don't wait. Go now to nuclearhotseat.com to donate. And know that whatever you can do to help, I am deeply grateful that you are listening and that you care. Now here's part two of this week's featured interview with Greg Mello of the Los Alamos Study Group, who is just back from the Nuclear Deterrence Summit in Washington, D.C. Outside of the official presentations, what was your experience in talking to any of these representatives who were there, or any of the people who were simply attending? Was there responsiveness to any of the points you were trying to make? Were you shut out? Was there a certain sense of, oh, there he is again?
Really more the latter, but one of the conference organizers kind of broke cover at one point and said, you know, this is all horrible. And I'm really, this is terrible. What's going on? And, oh, well, I guess we better get back to the session now. And so he went back to his persona. I think there are some people who understand perfectly well the risks that are being taken, the standards that are being abandoned, but no one knows how to stop it. There was a man sitting at my table for at least one day, maybe 2 days. I couldn't recognize him at first. He looked so familiar. And then I realized he was a very important internal critic of some of this within the NNSA. He had retired, and I hadn't seen him in a few years. And he didn't ask any questions because they all go to work for these consulting firms, you see. Pretty much everybody had an economic interest in the outcome.
It's like the revolving door between the nuclear industry and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, where they go in, they serve for 5 years or 10 years in the NRC and come out to a much better job with better perks and a higher salary.
Mm-hmm.
And that is known.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see, there was a very smart Air Force Lieutenant Colonel there, PhD, who, you know, very sure of himself, and I'm sure we could have gotten into a big argument. Some DOE officials were approachable and were pretty communicative. Others, I tended to want to ask questions that were embarrassing. So, I mean, the content of my questions had to do with scandals and delays and disagreement with policy and so forth. So I could tell some people were avoiding me.
I don't blame them because you've got the facts and you can nail them on it. Some of the quotes that you cited I find really alarming. There was an Admiral Papineau, who is Principal Deputy for the National Nuclear Security Administration, saying, "We are closer to a nuclear exchange than at any time during the Cold War." And having lived through the Cold War, that's a very frightening statement. And another administrator said, "We have crossed the threshold into a new world." It seems that there's a particular pride or hubris that we're now on the front lines of potentially destroying the entire planet and all life on it. Given the context and where these people were, how were their statements received? Was this like a rah-rah, we agree with you? Was there any kind of hesitancy at all? I'm looking for
No.
sanity here.
There was no hesitation, but in previous conferences, there had been some war whoops after a video showing launching of a Minuteman missile and really starting a nuclear war. And there wasn't any kind of anything like that. It was more sober, I would say, than some in the past, but there was not any disagreement at all.
You were clearly an outlier there. Was there anybody else who you saw or knew or bonded with or who had seen before who had anything close to your perspective opposing what was being said from the stage?
There was one woman there from a foreign policy discussion group, Vermont, and she was not aligned with what was being said. And she tried to ask a couple of, well, she did ask a couple of questions about nuclear waste, but it was not easy to get your footing in a meeting like this, where everything is cut and dried and it's very technical, very jargony. Everybody knows there's obviously hidden continuity. They're all buddies. And it is very difficult to get one's footing in such a situation. And she did the best she could. It was the first time she'd ever been to anything like that.
I assume that they don't send out invitations to the various anti-nuclear groups that are around the country to send a representative. How in the world have you gotten yourself into this, and how long have you been going?
I think I've gone to most of these since their inception under other management in 2001 or 2002, somewhere back there. So back in the early days, and even as recently as five, say 5 years ago, you could ask a lot of questions, and so you become kind of like a gadfly. Okay, here's Mello again. He's got a question of this panel too. And I had to, caution from the moderator one time, you're asking too many questions. Well, the contractors are sitting there silently because they don't want anyone to know how little they understand of what's going on some of the time. So I used to be invited because I would bring out things that made the conference interesting. And it also gives them the illusion of impartiality or objectivity. There was more of a journalistic, well, it was run by journalists in the past. And so we had to, write an application this time to get in. And the other way, reason that we get in is that we know things and we have a regular correspondence, well, irregular, but sporadic, with the reporters of this outfit that put on the conference. So I will send them stuff which is valuable for them to write their very expensive newsletter. They appreciate that. I also edit. I mean, not formally, but when they put out things which are wrong, I tell them. And so one of the reporters once said, "You're my most devoted reader among." So anyway, there's a little quid pro quo in this.
You also stated in the email that you sent out, the notification you sent out, that you visited a few offices on Capitol Hill and elsewhere. What can you tell us about that?
Not a great deal. I did mention that I was at the Defense Nuclear Facility Safety Board, where we are fans of them, and they are struggling to maintain their ability to make decisions and advise the DOE and Congress as they are supposed to do, because they have only one board member out of the five they are statutorily empowered to have. The staff is great, and the people they have are great altogether. And however, they don't have regulatory power, and like NRC has over nuclear reactors. So they're advisory. And right now, I'm sure that Mr. Trump would just as soon if abolish them if he could. The second best, of course, is to keep them crippled. And Biden did that. Biden never appointed a full slate of safety board members. And so now they have just one person.
You know, with all this talk about rolling back safety measures and the inability to step in and stop this juggernaut going forward for more nukes, it strikes me that the missing piece in people's understanding is of what radiation is, what it does, and how it impacts the human body from a nuclear blast. I'm in the process of reading, I'm almost completing Ghosts of Hiroshima, which is the book that's the basis for the James Cameron film coming up. I can't imagine what the special effects department is going to be coming up with for that, and the makeup department as well. But what I find new and remarkable is the specificity of what the bomb actually did to the people on the ground and the after effect of the radiation, but also the specifics of what that blast did in terms of vaporizing people and places and contaminated water and black rain and the horribleness of it all, which of course was blanked out because General MacArthur, who was in charge of Japan after the surrender, said it is illegal for anyone to report on the impact of radiation on these people or to tell the story of what happened to them. So, for all the years I've been doing this show and all my research, a tremendous amount of what's in this book was very new to me. And it's nauseating and it's difficult. And if it were known, it might have an impact on this push for more nukes because people don't understand what these things actually do. Do you think that there is any hope that when this movie comes out, as this book is passed around more thoroughly, as the movie comes out, I think that's going to be the big thing. Do you think there's any way that spreading the information graphically of exactly what radiation does in the wake of an atomic blast will do anything or can do anything to turn even the people who are in that room and pushing nukes so hard like it's toothpaste or breakfast cereal will look at this and go, hey, wait a minute, maybe I need to rethink it. Think there's anything that will get them to do that?
Good question. I think everything will help a little. I think that will help. The movie will help. And not magically, but getting authorities to be involved, influencers of both in the modern sense and in general, that's really important. A lot of people don't discriminate between an Hiroshima-sized bomb and a hydrogen bomb. That you did earlier in this conversation, rightly so. They don't know what a nuclear weapon does because it's beyond the imagination. And Hollywood has not been great in general on this so far because you have to have a surviving hero or heroine. And Ted Postel has been trying very hard to get across what these weapons do. And many people think, well, if there's a nuclear war, I'm likely to survive if I do this or that. And sometimes public authorities give that impression as well. And that's, if you don't have electricity, if nobody in your city or your state has electricity for 3 days and can't pump water, and you are in a very, very bad way. And then there's the fallout. So one nuclear bomb dropped on Los Alamos, which is 20 to 25 miles northwest of Santa Fe, New Mexico. If it were exploded at ground level, it would create enough fallout, a large Russian warhead, to kill about everybody in Santa Fe if the wind were blowing in that direction. So your life and death depends on the wind. People think, well, that's far away. That doesn't affect me. Well, it does. A Russian Poseidon underwater torpedo exploded in Long Beach Harbor. If it, no, we don't know how big the warhead is, but a 50 or 100 megaton warhead fits in that torpedo. And a warhead of that size would burn down all of Los Angeles. And the fallout would go well into the middle of Arizona. These weapons can be made arbitrarily large. And Ted Postol says, you know, the six Poseidons launched by one Russian submarine in the Atlantic could burn down a good part of the eastern seaboard of the United States. Because being under 5 or 10 feet of water makes no difference whatsoever if the explosion is that large. And you know, Trump has his absolutely absurd golden dome that he thinks could possibly, somebody has told him, could possibly protect the North American continent, but not from underwater weapons that travel at intercontinental distances at great depths and high speeds. This is absurd that anyone could have a defense against a nuclear attack by a peer competitor. One interesting anecdote from this conference is I asked a couple of people what they thought about the wisdom of starting an arms race with a country that could build $8,000 electric cars, meaning China. And they said, oh, yeah, that'd be crazy, wouldn't it? And yet then we would go back inside of the conference and where the speakers said we have to get ready to deter China with these new nuclear weapons. And the people that I spoke to just a few moments before acknowledged the futility of trying to keep up with China in developing weapons.
Which brings me to a question that this is all pointing to. Having had this summit, this glad handing of pro-nuclear yahoos, what does it look like the summit achieved going forward? What has come out of it, or what do you perceive coming out of it?
Well, I don't know because again, we're back behind closed doors for them. They now have their marching orders. They know what their mission is. That's what was achieved. They heard the bigwigs of the NNSA and they heard the commander of all US nuclear weapons who spoke, the STRATCOM commander in chief. And so they feel justified in what they're doing. I'd like to tell you one of the silver linings or difficulties they face, which is that they don't have enough workers. They never have enough workers. Now they're losing workers to data centers, of all things. So the enormous blue-collar workforce required to build the AI data centers is bleeding people from the nuclear weapons complex and the big factories that they are trying to make for nuclear weapons. Over at Pantex, they lost 60 craft workers in one day to a data center, which is being in the initial stages of construction across the road. One of my meetings was with the Government Accountability Office. From them, I learned the interesting anecdote that At least one data center is paying electricians $500,000 per year. They are short electricians. They will pay practically anything to get them. The nuclear weapons business can't afford that. They can afford a lot, but they can't afford that. I mean, we need people like that to help us with our home solar systems, with our farm solar systems, with rewiring our businesses and homes to be more energy efficient. I mean, we need workers like this, and it's infuriating that the nuclear weapons business sucks the talent away from these really important infrastructure needs in our society.
Given that you deal with this subject matter so intimately and so consistently and have for decades now, I've been asking this question of a lot of my interviewees. How do you keep yourself going? How do you keep yourself in good enough heart that you can get out of bed in the morning and do it all over again?
So, of course, there are friends. That's the most important thing. It's also that we know that the human conscience is everywhere. And the people who work in this industry are no better or worse than the rest of us. They plopped into this mess, and it can be very hard to get out. Once they start paying you what they can pay you, and you make certain commitments to your family, your children, and so forth. And we're all in it together. And I think it's important that we are very firm about how we handle these issues, but we can acknowledge our common humanity and realize that we're in it together. We've been in this a long time, and I don't think we're co-opted, but we are certainly, if you want to say, part of the system. The opposition is important, and even if we don't succeed immediately, sometimes we can, but we're in this for the long haul, and it is important to express values that would otherwise be forgotten. We all have experience in our communities or in our universities where they, oh, so and so, he's important. And then the so and so is retired or fired or something. And then all of a sudden, everything changes. Maybe we didn't realize it, but that person was holding up an important part of the tent of good values at that institution or in that community. And on that, and then it's gone. So I think we need to take stock about what the victories that we've had and the things that we are doing. We're alive thanks to the anti-nuclear movement. Yes, we're not making progress right now overall, but it would be very much worse if we weren't here. And we have, I think paradoxically, there are silver linings in this mess. So they are dancing very near to the precipice of accidents, of embarrassing fiascos, and pushing these old facilities and workers, which, they're not, this is not the Cold War. We're not going to have workers which are going to put their very lives at risk knowingly to produce nuclear weapons the way they did in the 1950s and 1960s. We're not going back to the heroic mode. People won't put up with that crap. And I know the Heritage Foundation, Robert Peters said the people who make plutonium pits need to be willing to sacrifice their lives to make plutonium pits the same way that soldiers on the battlefield are ready to sacrifice themselves for their country. I told him, you're not going to get any pits if that's your attitude, if you run things that way. Nobody's going to do that. People need to feel like they are within a system of values that, I mean, they might fool themselves to a great degree, but they can't fool themselves 100%. And they need to feel like they're doing something worthwhile, one way or another. And there's plenty of scope for us to explain to people this is not worthwhile, that the arguments being advanced in favor of building more nuclear weapons are the same arguments of the 1950s and 1960s that were discredited long ago. And people who think, yeah, we're going to control the world again, Mr. Trump, I think, believes we can't. Those days are past. And it was very ironic that all of the swag that was being passed out by the nuclear weapons contractors, and there was a very high quality of swag this year being given out, it was all made in China. We can't make that stuff here. So that kind of contradiction is a seed that grows, and I'm not discouraged.
It's good to hear. I have my good days and my bad days, and you helped me get back to the good days. You also made mention of them wanting their people to act in heroic mode, and I think you are an example of heroic mode on our side of the aisle. And for all that you have done, for all that you are doing, for all that you will do, Greg Miller, I want to thank you for the work and for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
It's a privilege, Libby, to be on your show with your other wonderful guests. Thanks so much, and please keep it up. I will too.
Greg Mello, Executive Director of the Los Alamos Study Group. I suggest that you get on the study group newsletter. We've got a link up to it at nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 763, and a few follow-up points from the interview. The use of the word deterrence instead of weapons is intentionally misleading, one of the nuclear industry's slipperiest talking points. The executive director of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, Melissa Park, gave a thorough analysis on why there is no such thing as nuclear deterrence, and using that term is a flat-out manipulative lie. She explains it thoroughly in our interview for Nuclear Hot Seat number 737 from August 12, 2025, and we will link to that episode on our website. The other link we'll provide is to Stephen Starr's book, which was mentioned prominently, Nuclear High Altitude Electromagnetic Pulse: A Mortal Threat to the U.S. Power Grid and U.S. Nuclear Power Plants. We don't need a bomb going off on U.S. soil for a nuke to cripple this country. A well-placed explosion in space is capable of taking out the electric grid in a nano. We'll have a non-Amazon link up if you wish to purchase the book. It will be on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 763. And Greg mentioned physicist Theodore A. Postal. He is a professor emeritus of science, technology, and national security policy at MIT, with an expertise in nuclear weapon systems, including submarine warfare, applications of nuclear weapons, ballistic missile defense, and ballistic missiles more generally. However Greg cited him, he is a man to be believed. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, February 10, 2026. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, we make it easy. Sign up for it on your favorite podcast channel or help us out. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, look for the yellow box, put in your first name and email address, and every week you will get one email with a link to that week's show as soon as it posts and a short description of its content. Now, group participation time. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, any amount will help us out. And we really appreciate your support, so in advance, thank you. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2026, Libby Halevy and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevy of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that, as Albert Einstein said, I know not with what weapons World War III will be fought, but World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones. There you have it.
your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.